it's clear to probably all of you who are already subscribed to my channel that the COVID-19 hysteria has come about as a direct result of propaganda. It has been an intentional deception designed to create hysteria, mass hysteria, in the population. But the only way that can work is if people are deriving their sense of the risk of COVID-19 exclusively from the liars. If all they're doing is watching CNN and these carefully crafted propaganda pieces that are designed to create as much fear as possible, and if all they're doing is then maybe trying to gain a sense from the curated and censored content on some of the main media platforms, we know that the people who are still terrified, who were initially terrified and or are still terrified, are so as a result of the fact that they have allowed somebody else to control all the information that comes in through their senses, and they have not taken the time to do the math and realize how absolutely ridiculous all of this is. In addition to that, even if we accept their numbers, and we have absolutely no reason to accept their numbers because they are lying and they are intentionally trying to create hysteria, even if we accept their numbers, it's still ridiculous. This idea that 60 million people die globally every year, and that is perfectly okay, but all of a sudden we're supposed to surrender every basic human right that's enshrined in our constitutions. Well, you know, different countries have different constitutions, but the general idea of freedom of speech, freedom of being able to interact with other people, freedom to work and earn a living in lawful businesses, all of these are pretty basic things that are being destroyed here, with the pretext being that there may be again, accepting their numbers, a less than 3% variation in the annual normal mortality rate of the global population. It's crazy. Now factor in, again, that they're lying about everything, and that 20 to 25 million seniors die every year, 20 to 25 million. Do you think that maybe they're harvesting the vast majority of those COVID deaths from that 20 to 25 million? Not to mention now there are no, the flu deaths are magically down. We know they're harvesting from that as well. I don't want to get too much into this. We understand the concept of the people who have been taken in by that fear and how they will remain in that mindset until they start doing the math themselves and or start getting some other pieces of information from other experts, for instance. The 11,000 plus experts who disagree with the probably less than 100 experts who have crafted this narrative and shaped this global policy. But what about us, these people who know what's going on? Is it possible that we too still are being affected by propaganda? I'm going to read here. I've got a couple things here that I'm going to post or that I'm going to read that are from sheriffs here in Ohio. This first one: I have received several calls about the governor's suggestion that everyone wear a mask. Well, it is up to the business owners to enforce this, as they do with the requirements to wear a shirt and shoes. There is no law to enforce, so please do not call us in regards to this. The health department would be the ones to call. Along with that, the governor of Ohio has suggested a curfew from 10 p.m. till 5 a.m. for the next 3 weeks. Again, we do not have the authority, the time, or the willingness to even attempt to enforce this. Your deputies will continue to enforce laws and investigate crimes in the county to keep people safe. So, again, using just a basic feel based on the information that's curated and censored and provided to us, we might think that of these 524 reactions here, quite a few are going to be angry that the sheriff dared to post such a thing. Well, I'm happy to inform you that that is how many people are angry out of 524. It is literally 65 to 1 in favor. They either like, 65-1, either like or love this post. 365 more, it says at the bottom there, and 110 more at the bottom there. That's not the only one we got here. Here's another one. Waynesfield Police Department, Governor's curfew order response for residents. Governor Mike DeWine's curfew order will be effective for 21 days beginning at 10 p.m. on Thursday. After being on a 36-minute phone conference with the Ohio Department of Public Safety that followed the governor's press conference, here is the official statement from Waynesfield Police Chief Nathan Motter on behalf of the Waynesfield Police Department. Quote, the Waynesfield Police Department will absolutely not be conducting traffic stops on vehicles for curfew violations, as the order has more holes in it than Swiss cheese. Politics aside, this latest order is quite literally impossible to enforce due to the number of exceptions and loopholes. No matter what law enforcement does with this order, attempt to enforce it or not enforce it, we lose. People are likely to complain on both sides, and civil liability is still very much unclear. Therefore, just as the Waynesfield Police Department has not been the mask police, we will not be policing adult curfew violations. If you wish to report such a violation, call the Ohio Department of Health. So, how many people of the nearly 600 here approved of this message? Based on the media, if you watch CNN, oh, these are the crazy outliers, right? This is the 10% maybe would approve of this, but 90% know how deadly and dangerous and how necessary all these things are. It is literally 100-1. And to be honest with you, I'm not even sure what this care emoji means. But there are 6 people under this care emoji, and then all of the rest of the 600 have either liked or loved this. So the purpose of this video really is to make clear that I think that we have to be careful that we're not being swayed without realizing it into thinking that we are a smaller number than we actually are.
House openly attacked the grotesque American Constitution because it prevented the government from collecting an income tax from its citizens. Shortly after House's choice for president, Woodrow Wilson, was placed in office, the grotesque constitutional barrier was removed, and the money began to flow. Sadly, few Americans realized that the United States did not have a permanent personal income tax prior to 1913. Think about that for a minute. America went from being a sparsely settled nation of wilderness in 1776 to the most prosperous and arguably most powerful nation on the planet without an income tax. Contrary to the popular canard, a lack of income tax does not mean your country's doomed, socially, politically, militarily, and economically, to the global status of Somalia. Here's another little-known fact about the income tax. If we abolish the personal income tax today, the federal government would still collect about $3 billion per day, $125 million per hour in revenue. Compare that to its revenue in 1913 of less than $1 billion per year, and the obscenity of what the network has achieved becomes pretty clear. Even after adjusting for inflation, the numbers are still alarming. $1 billion per year in 1913 would equal about $25 billion per year today. And at the current rate of federal spending, that inflation-adjusted $25 billion would be gone in a little over 2 days. Despite the fact that Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke returned to Jekyll Island in 2010 to commemorate the Fed's founding 100 years earlier, still the vast majority of people have never heard of the trip to Jekyll Island and have no idea that international bankers created the system that was supposed to protect them from international bankers. But again, should we be surprised? The education system and mainstream media are the two most powerful instruments for distributing information and creating mass awareness. Regarding the media, just a handful of global news corporations can, in one day, make billions of people around the world simultaneously aware of something that was completely unknown the day before. With this kind of power, the network can choose to spread any lie or withhold any truth that it chooses. Then there's education. Millions of students can be taught the real story behind the Federal Reserve System, or they can be taught the smokescreen of government intervention to protect the public. They can be taught the dangers of centralized banking power, or they can be taught nothing at all. At the end of the day, if people aren't looking beyond the network's instruments for their information, they cannot expect to know what the network doesn't want them to know. But this lone voice was easily drowned by the great cacophony of deception and propaganda. The newly packaged Glass-Owen Federal Reserve Act, which mirrored Aldrich's version in all essential provisions, was put forward by Democrats as being radically different, a bill written by selfless public servants to protect the citizenry from selfish, out-of-control banking interests. And as Vanderlip, Aldrich, and other big business Republicans continue to attack the new legislation, more and more well-meaning Americans fell for the ruse. Let's not forget what the father of propaganda, Edward Bernays, had to say about tactics like this. The voice of the people expresses the mind of the people, and that mind is made up for it by those persons who understand the manipulation of public opinion. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind and contrive new ways to guide the world. Meanwhile, as the citizens were being guided to the desired opinion publicly, Edward Mandel House ensured that Wilson and Congress were being properly guided privately. The intimate papers of Colonel House leave little doubt that he acted as the direct liaison between the network and relevant politicians during the creation of the central bank. House directed the politicians, while Paul Warburg, the primary author of the Jekyll Island legislation, directed House. Ed Griffin summarizes House's role this way. As far as the banking issue is concerned, Colonel House was the president of the United States, and all interested parties knew it. Wilson made no pretense at knowledge of banking theory. He said, quote, "The greatest embarrassment of my political career has been that active duty seemed to deprive me of time for careful investigation. I seem almost obligated to form conclusions from impressions instead of from study. I wish that I had more knowledge, more thorough acquaintance with the matters involved." To which Charles Seymour adds, quote, "Colonel House was indefatigable in providing for the president the knowledge that he sought. The colonel was the unseen guardian angel of the bill." First on page 58, Quigley presents what he calls a paradox of banking practice. Bankers prefer monetary deflation, a reduction in the money supply, because it increases both the value of the money that they control and the interest rates that they can charge borrowers. However, he states that they inevitably abandon the deflationary idea in favor of inflating the money supply, which they accomplish by issuing bank loans, because of their eagerness to lend money at interest. To Quigley's credit, he acknowledges that bankers can gain an extra form of profit from this supposed conflict. By increasing the money supply with loans, they increase the indebtedness of others and drive prices up. Then, by decreasing the money supply, they can force many debtors into foreclosure and confiscate whatever collateral was pledged to secure their loans. He also acknowledges that this manipulation of the money supply was a prominent aspect of the so-called business cycle, and that it was, quote, "destructive to business and industry." So here's the question. Where is the paradox? If you're a member of the network, this is a fundamental feature of the banking system that you've created. What better way to crush or control competitors in business and industry? You not only enjoy the normal benefits of controlling loans, loaning money only to those who yield control and withholding it from those who resist, but you also have a mechanism for trapping debtors and then seizing their assets. If you do decide to confiscate their collateral, rather than bury the borrower in additional debt with additional strings attached, you've effectively gained ownership of a real asset with money that you created out of thin air. Remember, that's how our current banking system operates. When the network wants to issue a loan, it pulls a check from its magic checkbook, writes it in the loan amount, and poof, the money for the loan is created on the spot. If these myths were accepted as true, then his assertion that bankers sincerely tried to save the gold standard makes perfect sense. However, a closer look at their actions and the ways in which they benefited from those actions leads to a more logical conclusion. It was far more profitable to destroy the gold standard than it was to preserve it. To create ever-increasing piles of money and debt out of thin air, the limitations of gold had to be removed. On pages 256 and 257 of Tragedy and Hope, Quigley nearly stumbles into the truth. While discussing the beginning of World War I, he tells the story of military men and financial experts who believed the war would be over within 6 months. This prediction was based on the fact that gold reserves, used to pay for the expenses of war, would be depleted within that amount of time. However, by suspending the gold standard, the duration of the war, along with the enormous debts and banker profits associated with it, grew far beyond anything that a gold standard would have supported. Quote, "All the great powers were on the gold standard under which paper money could be converted into gold on demand. However, each country suspended the gold standard at the outbreak of war. This removed the automatic limitation on the supply of paper money. Each country proceeded to pay for the war by borrowing from the banks. The banks created the money, which they then lent by merely giving the government a deposit of any size against which the government could draw checks. The banks were no longer limited in the amount of credit they could create because they no longer had to pay out gold for checks on demand. The problem of public debt became steadily worse because governments were financing such a large part of their activities by bank credit." From this perspective, the advantages of permanently suspending the gold standard are self-evident. When a bank creates paper money loans that are backed by gold, it runs the risk of losing its gold reserves. When a bank creates paper money loans that are backed by nothing, then its gold reserves are perfectly safe. Additionally, without gold backing, there are no longer any firm limits on how many loans the banking system can create. Limits, if any, are determined by the wishes of those who control the system, and the limitless borrowing needs of government, business, and individuals. They enjoy the influence of having monopolized the creation of money itself. Stated another way, when a monopoly capitalist accumulates his first $1 billion, it's only because others have borrowed that $1 billion into existence from the network's banking system. If Quigley truly understood the network's banking system, he would have never fallen for the lie, undoubtedly perpetuated by the network itself, that banking power peaked in the 1930s. The exact opposite is true. It wasn't until the 1930s that international bankers began chipping away at the limitations of gold and inching the world ever closer to a purely debt-based standard. As powerful as the network's position was under the gold standard, it has increased immeasurably under their 100% debt-based standard. They can now create, destroy, and direct as much money as they see fit. They currently earn interest on every single dollar in existence, because every single dollar in existence has been created and loaned into the economy by them. Accordingly, their debt-based system guarantees that nations will remain forever trapped in debt. As a nation and its citizens attempt to reduce their debt to bankers, they simultaneously reduce their nation's money supply. Paying off all debt would reduce the money supply to zero. Not only would this be impossible, but financial chaos and emergency government borrowing would be triggered long before any significant reduction in debt was achieved. This is not a system that was designed with our best interests in mind.
But I wanna stay for you, me. I say it's gonna put some love in your life. Don't you really wanna know how it feels? Everybody wanna see what it's like. We even wanna be inside. It ain't last. We all know there's better things in this life.
Sanitize.